Dog.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast, Taking It Down. We are the Pop Culture Discussion Pod for the Alabama Take, and there's plenty more to see, hear, and read over on the site. I encourage you to have a look, and that's not just because I'm the editor-in-chief there. It's because every time you click on something to read, an angel gets his robe. Help our angels. Plus, we want to shout out those who have left us reviews online. We have a generous and kind and thoughtful review from Apple user Rim Running Ragged, who said that we defied his or her expectations about some Alabama dudes talking about basketball on television. So we appreciate that. If you have time, leave us a review online. We'll see it and we'll say something, perhaps. But in today's episode, if you're not familiar with the format, we'll have our two usual segments. In the first bit, we're going to focus a lot on the new Andy Samberg and Kristen Melody film on Hulu, which is called Palm Springs. After the break, we're going to be talking more about the latest few episodes of the HBO noir reboot of Perry Mason, which stars Matthew Rhys. We have a lot to talk about beyond those two things, though. And joining me today is co-host Adam Morrow and our frequent guest and sometimes friend, Donovan Reinwald.
Sometimes.
First, let's get going. I want to ask both of you, what do you think COVID is doing today? What's COVID up to?
Rocking out somewhere. Just bopping right behind the scenes.
Yeah, no, I think you know what I bet COVID's doing? I bet it's just downloaded a nice Quibi.
He's got the app fired up, got Quibi up and running.
Just, like, can't make enough content to satisfy COVID.
Probably it has it open on its little app somewhere in the back of one of those unmarked vans in Portland, just waiting on the party to start back there.
How banging do you think one of those COVID vans is?
Probably a pretty damn good time.
It's a riot.
Oh, patoom-ching, man.
My understanding is that it's banging in the very literal sense of the word.
Mm. I think COVID's just licking its lips, waiting for school to open. It's just pumped. Like, fall is here.
Bring it on. You thought the bar was sweet. Let's talk about children packed into a room.
You know, kids lick each other anyway, even when it's not COVID time. Like, wait until they lick each other, then come home and lick you.
Now, I don't want to preempt the Morrow movie marathon portion of today's show, but
I didn't know we had one today.
But I will tell you that I just recently watched The Florida Project. Have you guys seen that?
Yes,
I have not.
It's so good.
But there's a scene. Obviously, if you know anything about the movie, it's about kids in a kind of a long-term motel in Florida, which is, you know, if you just want to like just make the map of the most depressing topic possible, that may do it. So, but there's a scene where three kids are sharing one ice cream cone. And it's so funny, like what I've become like just horrified by in watching like quote unquote normal times on the screen. I'm like, oh God, kids, no, you can't do that anymore.
We were sharing
you can't
that,
be that close.
It's how everyone gets herpes.
Yeah.
I don't want to sidetrack too much. The Florida Project's great. The best review I read of it on Letterboxd was Willem Dafoe? No, Willem Dafriend.
That's so stupid, and I love it. Also, it's perfect.
It's so good.
That may be the best thing we've had on the podcast.
Willem Dafoe is like, the last thing that I saw him in was at Eternity's Gate. So he played Vincent Van Gogh in that one. And here he's playing like the maintenance man manager at this motel. And he looked like this guy in this one, this guy that I used to work with. And he kind of talked this all the time. Did that kind of thing. And he's just like selling this dude perfectly. What a great movie. Anyway, I really just wanted to talk about that ice cream cone those kids shared and how that was a preview of the fall to come.
This is a callback to the normal people ice cream cone that they never Chekhov's ice cream popsicle that's still melting on the floor of that bedroom. And I, every night I wake up at 3 a.m, just startled away, wondering what the hell happened to that ice cream.
Well, it's Ireland, so it's probably fine. It's not like the face of the damn sun like we're living on.
I don't know. That's how you get ants, no matter where you are.
That's true. Even a solid piece of ice cream, the ants are coming for it.
That's right. They're marching in.
So, to reel this in, Blaine's
going to edit this all out.
No, it's fine. We're going to get into streaming stuff. Peacock streaming service from Universal and NBC, and I think Comcast is involved, whatever. Just got released, I think, last week. Do either of you get that? Adam, I think you and I do not get it. Once again, Roku and Amazon are fucked out of it. So, Donovan, you want to brag about watching Peacock this week?
I think the question really comes down to, do you enjoy watching Vertigo with ads? Of course you do.
Nothing says Hitchcockian like Tide detergent.
You can do it on Peacock. You know, I considered cracking it open, because last week to try and get idiots like me to check it out, they showed like 6 or 7 Premier League games, no commercials. Yeah, yeah. But I didn't watch any. Yeah. I it's too much.
It's too much. What do you mean it's too much?
One more streaming service. Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to pay for it. Yeah. I thought you meant it's too much that you had that many options to watch soccer games.
It seems. Oh, yeah. No, that's fine. It seems cool. Like, I think ad supported is smart. Because I think it just lowers the barrier, right? Like, you hook people in. I mean, it's kind of like what Hulu used to be, but now we pay for it and we still have ads. So.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like the Spotify thing, which partnered with Hulu, which. You know, evil minds think alike, I guess. But I will say that I have been using NBC Gold, the sports thing, for a couple years to watch soccer, and it's they do a really nice job with that. So if that carries over into the Peacock, which every time I see that word or hear it, I just think of that Katy Perry song. So it emphasizes the second part of the word peacock quite a bit, Blaine. You seem to make a puzzle face there.
Katy Perry references usually go right over my head.
Well, we don't have to talk about why she's the great pop singer of the early 2010s on this episode of the podcast, but maybe on down the line.
That should be a definite.
The Cyndi Lauper of her era, if you will.
Well, to segue into another piece of streaming that Donovan made a joke about earlier is this apparent demise of Quibi, right? If you don't know what that is, if you're a listener, you don't know what that is, you're not alone. It's okay.
You don't have to anymore.
You don't have to, because here's the thing. It's the original streaming platform designed or headed or whatever by Jeffrey Katzenberg. I don't guess he designed it. He probably just heads the company.
He looked at his piles of money and said, what if I set this on fire?
Yeah.
And Quibi was born.
Rather than helping COVID-stricken... Okay, no, I'm not going to get back into COVID. But anyway, Quibi... Katzenberg was one of the head honchos of Pixar and a very high-ranking guy at Disney, if you can remember Once Upon a Time in the 90s. And Quibi's a streaming service that was only available on your fucking phone. And it produced original content, movies, shows, things like that, that you'd watch in, wait for it, Quick Bites, Quibi. Hence the awful name. And, you know, it would do like episodes or blocks that wouldn't be any more than 8 or 10 minutes the most. And this service is apparently in the news this past week because it's pretty much failing. It's failing. And because the app isn't being downloaded, they said they wanted to make it available to television, but that's not been done yet.
That's the funniest thing to me. Like, people love being on their phones. You know, Jeffrey Katzenberg, just like, what are the kids doing?
Exactly.
Now they can't get it on TV and it's dying.
Mm-hmm. So they had to get it on TV. We disparaged it. Adam and I disparaged it back when it was first launched, saying to the effect, I think our summary was, I'm not paying for anything to watch on my phone. I think it's $4.99 for a version with ads, $7.99.
Yeah. No, and also, I quickly figured out when people started streaming concerts that I don't have the attention span to sit there and try to make it through without opening other things on my phone.
Absolutely. Exactly. Have you ever, when you're on a website, you know, and it's like article, video, fuck that.
Yes. Give me the written version of it.
This poop is on a... You know, it's on a time limit here. I don't have time for video. Video essay. What is that?
I'm with you.
My coworkers could hear. And then there's the other bathroom issue is you bringing your headphones in there. You know, your coworkers could hear you.
Yeah, what's weirder is like the audio coming out from under the stall door or walking to the bathroom with your headphones. Which one is weirder? Neither are a great option. Just give me a text article.
I have definitely been in the summer in the library when I had to weed out a collection all by myself. Like, I'm not hitting pause on this podcast. I'm just keeping the headphones on.
Well, there you go.
Let's go. I washed my hands.
Who's that hurting? I did want to say, I wanted to recount this story for those listeners who don't really read. There was a article in New York Magazine a week or two ago about Katzenberg. And so get this, here's the story that really makes him just seem utterly tone deaf. Gal Gadot, I think is her name, right? So she goes into a meeting with Katzenberg to talk about the possibility of creating something for Quibi. And he goes on and on about how he wants her to be the new Jane Fonda and produce workout videos for Quibi. And she's left aghast and just, it's, you know, take that with what you will.
She seems like an honest woman to me. I don't see why she would lie about Jeffrey Katzenberg trying to.
Did he offer like a cooking show? Was that like his other option?
For real?
That's awful.
That's one way to be more tone deaf, I suppose, is offer her some kind of food thing.
I see two lanes for you.
Yeah.
Fitness or Rachel Ray? You're gonna be a star, kid.
Take a pick.
Yeah.
All right. We are going to do one more thing of house cleaning, and we'll make it quick. Adam, this is for you. Is there anything challenge related that you need to get out of your system since the finals aired Wednesday?
We'll just go ahead and throw up the spoiler warning here, I suppose, right? And
if you don't watch the challenge live or close enough to live, just turn us off.
Yeah. So I thought the ending, the result was very satisfying. The people I wanted to win, they won. It was great. I think I got two things. One, the handling of Melissa's pregnancy during that final was, apparently she found out she was pregnant on the mountain. Like at some point, or maybe they had to do a physical, like before they do a physical going in to the house and then a physical to make sure that they can survive this insane final of some sort. And so like when she quit, the producers didn't tell anybody else. Only her and the producers knew. They pulled TJ to the side. We talked about this week and told him, hey, don't go in on her like you usually do on the quitters. And he didn't know why. So I thought that I wanted her to do better so badly. I felt like the show could have done her. It's her private life, but she's been very open about it. I don't know. I was rooting for her. So that's one, the handling of the pregnancy there. Two, I think that this was a very impressive final, and this is a much bigger point than the first one. I feel like this was physically a much more impressive final than it got credit for. There were people who are saying like, well, there weren't enough. All they did was race, you know, and there's like one puzzle. I think one, they edited a bunch of stuff out, probably. There may have been some like failed attempts at other.
Did they edit out Dee hiding in the snow?
Yeah, I think she was still there. But apparently like there was a knife throwing part of the challenge that didn't make the final cut. I just think, you know, you get up into the mountains outside, they're in Austria somewhere, and a blizzard breaks out. Like, how are you going to, you got to work with what you got. Like, apparently one of the cameramen fell down like a crevasse or something. They had to like fish this cameraman out. Like just the logistics of pulling this off, I feel like kind of betrayed how impressive the win was. Kudos to Bananas. Kudos to Jenny. I wish it would have been maybe a two-part episode instead of a one, but nice finale. You got anything else to add, challenge-wise? I feel like this is your first season that you made it all the way through. I know we talked at length last week.
First season I made it all the way through in years.
In years. Coming back.
Yeah, and meeting. Mm-hmm. No, I loved it. I thought I've been seeing it dissed online as being one of the worst seasons, but let me tell you something. Looking at it with fairly fresh eyes, I thought it was pretty captivating. So I don't have anything to add. I agree with all your points. I'm glad Johnny Bananas is going to be solidified as the greatest ever challenge competitor, at least until somebody comes along and wins 8 or 9. So yeah, I'm happy.
There were some contenders for that on the mountain with him too. I think Rogan or Fessy could make a run, but we'll
I think
see.
So. Yeah, we will. All right. So there you go. But we got one more hit of challenge material coming on the Alabama Take, I think this week or next week. So keep your eye on that. Here's what we're gathered to do. We're gathered to talk about. Speaking of Morrow Movie Marathon, this is part of the Morrow Movie Marathon. Here's the deal.
Sure was.
It really was. So our coverage of Palm Springs, that's a Hulu exclusive movie starring Andy Samberg. Help me with this young lady's name, this actress's name. Kristen Melody? Melody?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Melody, okay. Apologies if I'm butchering her name.
I think that's it.
If you're a regular listener to this podcast, you know I butcher names. That's just my downfall. Directed by Max Bark. Here we go again. Max B. Gosh, that was horrible of me. But anyway, it's his first time as a director. So he's kind of new. One of the reasons why I can't pronounce his name is I don't think I've ever heard his name pronounced. But anyway, good job by him. We're going to get into some of this. It's a movie about these two people who meet at a wedding weekend, but end up having a very similar day over and over. I don't want to get into any more yet. The movie's doing quite well on Hulu, according to their press, and it's done better than any movie over a particular 3-day span, I think, recently. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, it's like getting a lot of attention, a lot of eyes are being put on it, and we'll get into why. But first, I feel like everything viewers of this movie is going to hinge on this, and I'll just go around, okay? Adam, you give us a start. Fill in the blank here. To me, Andy Samberg is
hilarious.
Daddy.
I say it again?
Daddy.
I thought that's what you said, but I wasn't sure.
He's 41 now. I'm afraid that I might, if I met him, I might be like, thanks, Dad. And then, geez, it's like calling the teacher mom. I think he kind of has like that like goofy shtick, and I'm there for it. He's a funny dude.
I wanted to ask that because to me, Andy Samberg is annoying until I start watching him, and then I realize, okay, he's not annoying.
See, that's the thing with him, and I think we can get into why that works in this movie is, you know, when you think back to like the Lonely Island stuff and them just being total goofballs on SNL, and like, I mean, I was in high school when the Chronicles of Narnia rap was just like everywhere, yeah. And I thought, I mean, I was like, just in the crosshairs of who that was made for sure. Thought that was hilarious. Then later in college, the On a Boat, all that stuff. And it's so stupid, but it's so clever and funny and like lighthearted, joyful at the same time. And then you think about all the stuff he's been in. Like even he has like one of the funniest cameos in Parks and Rec, the one episode appearance. Like he's just like, he brings, he's like he's just a ball of joy and he's funny.
He is. I totally agree with that because, like, his comic persona too is like that. He's not mean, right?
Right.
Like, he's goofy.
Right.
Sometimes he's dim. Like sometimes he's just a goofball, but like he's never mean, right? So like he's always kind of like. Also, I think Adam, you kind of hit on this with like Lonely Island and the movies he did. I think part of what makes I really like that the stuff he's done and like the Lonely Island dudes, like he literally grew up with, like they're his best friends from childhood. They made movies together. Like Hot Rod is great. It's a great parody of like a little inspirational indie movie, you know. And it's
Hot
just
Rod
that kind
of
like
it's one of my favorite comedies.
They're
Hot
doing
Rod
so
is.
Much good stuff, but it's also just feels like friends making each other laugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which
yeah.
And nobody record this because everything I'm complimenting Adam Sandler for, I will like say it in an angry tone of voice for Adam Sandler movies. Just feels like friends making each other laugh. Stop farting, David Spade.
Yeah, fair enough. He does remind me of like a younger Adam Sandler in a way. I thought about this. This is like a mirror to, you know, like when they revealed how many people watch the Adam Sandler movies that are like the straight to Netflix things, and you're like, who's watching these?
Yeah,
but like, I get why people watch it for the same reason that I enjoy his stuff.
Sandberg also does it a killer Adam Sandler impression, if you've seen that on Saturday Night Live before. It is good. It's great. So Sandberg is this guy, if I see him on my Facebook feed, Twitter feed, or whatever, I'm like, ah, that guy is kind of annoying. But then I start watching him, and I'm like, no. I love this guy. He's hilarious. Why did I think he was annoying? Same thing happened with me with Palm Springs, the movie we're about to start talking about. So what were your general thoughts? Just maybe real broad, because this movie has a bit of a spoiler kind of thing going on. We won't get there yet. So, you know, I saw headlines that kept insisting that this was not a Groundhog Day ripoff, and that insistence made me shrug it off until co-host Adam texted me about it. Not Adam Sandler, Adam Morrow, and said it was pretty good. And I thought, well, all right, that'd be something good to talk about for the show. And I watched it. Glad I did. I'll leave it at that with glad I watched it. And Adam, what was your broad takeaway?
I think we've been watching a lot of movies through the last few months, and you can only watch so many Florida projects, so many like of that kind of like heavy, as wonderful as they are. Sometimes you just think like, oh, it's Friday night. I want to watch 90 minutes of like something kind of more lighthearted, even if there's like a more dramatic story in there as well. Like Andy Samberg makes me laugh. This looks colorful. It looks fun. And honestly, when I clicked on it, I kind of knew what the premise was because it's in a bunch of the trailers and even some of the advertising, but clicked on it and it said Andy Samberg and rom-com. And I was like, you know what? I'm in. I'm not always in for a rom-com, but I'm in right now. And it totally delivered on that front.
I probably watched this in literally the worst because do you ever do this where you're like, you watch two movies right next to each other?
Of course.
And one inevitable. So I watched Ingmar Bergman's Through a Glass Darkly the night before. So like.
Pairs well with.
Yeah. So nothing. So like my brain was broken from that. So I watched it and I liked it. I didn't love it though. It felt like if we're going out of four stars, this was maybe 2.5 or 3. Like there were a lot of good elements in this cake here. A lot of stuff I love by itself, but it never quite came together for me. And I did kind of want it to be funnier, if that makes sense. Like it was more like it was kind of like a, maybe gentle or dramedy funny, but there were some also. That sounds, I'm underselling it too. There were some moments that made me just laugh out loud. They were so perfect.
No, you're right. If I went in thinking 90-minute movie at, you know, Sandberg, and I'm going to get a good hot rod experience because that movie makes me laugh hard. And it's not a laugh hard movie. In fact, let's get into spoilers right now. And, okay. Yeah. So the specifics of some of this is that, or specifics of my enjoyment of it, I think, is that it was a comedy about something, you know, it wasn't a very broad, it was very specific, maybe high-minded would be almost a word if you can think of Sandberg being high-minded, but there was this just philosophical sense behind the movie, I think. Not just does he love her, does she love him, sort of rom-com kind of thing. Will they get together? So it stretched the idea of a rom-com to a different place, like using the repeated day, the kind of Groundhog Day thing, as a metaphor for marriage, which, you know, Groundhog Day did it for a different reason, and Palm Springs does that idea of reliving the same day as almost a philosophical statement on relationships and marriage, you know, and that might be a real simplistic reading or a dumb reading, but that's kind of what I took away.
No, that definitely seemed to be the takeaway from it, and kind of like, you know, it also asked questions about comfort versus reality and kind of where you know, that he gets so used to the day, is he even trying to get out? Those kind of things. So like it has both of the, are we together because we don't have a choice, mm-hmm. or, you know, am I, have I, this thing that I hate, have I slowly kind of learned to love my limitations in the same way that like you may hate a job that you have, or, you know, a town that you, whatever you can extrapolate across different circumstances.
The thing that I agree with what both of y'all said. And I think that I felt like this movie almost had a stronger hour than it had the last 30 minutes. where everything where they really started kind of highlighting exactly what you said, Blaine, and exactly what you said, Adam, right? Like where Andy Samberg's character is like, you know, I don't know, but I'm safe here and I could stay here with you. They're talking about if they want to get out. And, you know, talking about like, oh yeah, like you're in love with me. Of all the people that could be stuck in a time loop with, you know, I'm your soulmate. But it all just kind of felt like real rushed together right at the end. Like it kind of, It's like, oh, okay, cool ideas. But also like the characters are just kind of saying it, you know what I mean? Instead of inhabiting it. Just because I felt like they were just rushing to finish it up right at the end there.
That's fair, especially when the beginning and getting towards the middle felt very lived in.
Yeah.
As they kind of like piece together what's happening as he kind of discovers her story that she's running from. That all felt very realized. I get what you're saying there.
Especially with, I don't know why, but I liked that Andy Samberg's character has been in this loop for a while. So there's kind of a, felt one of the better laughs or jokes of the movie is kind of probably what 15, 20 minutes in when you figure out he's been doing all this before. So all of his like, it's not that he's just a checked out asshole. It's just, he's done this 10,000 times.
Mm-hmm.
And so it starts to, you know, it starts to, there is some good stuff there.
I mean, he's staying right. Pretty cheery for as checked out as he is.
Well, he had a lot to drink.
They do kind of yada yada the time loop aspect, which I appreciated, you know.
Same.
It starts with him in the time loop and there's no, you know, I like that they trust their viewers to have seen this kind of thing in Groundhog Day. And what's the name of the Tom Cruise movie where he lives the same battle over
Edge of Tomorrow.
There you go.
I'm very familiar with this film.
Yeah. And it's good. It's a good film.
It is great.
So it's a smart move to start with Niles already in the loop. I want to talk about J.K. Simmons.
Man, talk about laugh out loud moments.
The bright spot.
He was great. He's great in everything, though, isn't he?
Yes, he is. And I love
commercials.
J.K. Simmons got to play his two best modes, in my opinion, which was angry and scary, like a combination of angry and being scared of him. And his other one, I think his best flip side, which he's multidimensional, trust me. But his other favorite for me is calm and father-like.
Yeah.
And it was only one or the other this time. So really a feast for you with J.K. Simmons.
Yeah, it's enjoyable.
When he shows up and you don't really know what his deal is yet, like that was just shoots him with the arrow. That was perfect. Especially because like Andy Samberg kind of reverts to type where he's like, just says something sort of weird. Like, I thought that was you. I smelled you.
It's great. And the super cut of him torturing.
Oh man, that was awesome.
And that was one of the funnier moments. I don't know. It's kind of like a horrifying realization when he's like, hey, you can't die, but you can feel pain. And there's nothing worse than being in the ICU and them keeping you awake. Or something. It's like, oh man, that is like horror film level awful.
Yeah, they didn't go into it a whole bunch, but it seems that he's kind of evolved the moral code, right? Where he's like, well, pain is real. Even if I'm just repeating this day, I have to remember it, right? And so if I'm inflicting pain on other people, that pain is real. I thought that was actually... See, I kind of hated that, you know, all these cool ideas got jumbled together at the end. Because I thought, like, what existentialist play is that from, you know? Like, what?
Well, and she seems immediately willing to be violent and to do kind of more extreme things. And you get the sense that even though he's learned how to live in that world, he maybe has less of that initial impulse than she does.
I wonder if we just didn't see that for him because he's been in there like a million years or something.
I wondered about that, but he seems, it just seems more baked into his nature, I guess, to like be, maybe it's just me reading into goofy Andy Samberg more than the character itself, but.
There were times though that the character of Sarah and Niles, it seemed like 20 years ago, those roles would have been reversed. Like, she had the troubled backstory of sleeping around and being drunk all the time. And they kind of brought her out of that.
Right, because that's an interesting thought. I didn't really think about that.
But I do think that if I'm going to knock anything about it, the editing, and this might go hand in hand with Donovan's complaint, which was the editing at times felt rushed in a couple of scenes and even jumpy. And that's common, I understand, for comedy and pacing, because you don't want to linger on a particular joke incredibly long. But
pacing, I mean, pacing is absolutely everything, right? Like with a comedy, you have to, right. If you don't nail the, I mean, if you don't like the unsung heroes, right? Like the editor of any movie, especially a comedy, you know, gosh, you know, cause sometimes it's like the choices, do I do that, do I have the joke? And then like something's about to happen, right? And then I cut away and deal with the aftermath. Do I keep going until it's funny? You know, like, well, how do I do this? And I think that you can kind of almost see that with people who haven't made a lot of funny movies or think maybe it's just going to be easy to make a funny movie. The timing is just not quite right, you know, because it's not, you can't just luck into it. You have to really know what you're doing.
And it is the sort of movie that you, it seems to be these days, you only get on streaming services, or you only will watch them on streaming services because of the blockbuster only move for theaters, you know? So.
Yeah. And it really works on a streaming service to me, because this is like, I don't know, maybe if I zoom back to a time that I didn't have most of the movies in the world at my fingertips, like I would have gone to see this to blow off some steam in the same way that I did by watching it at home. But I mean, definitely now there's no way I would have gone to the theater for this, but had a good time watching it at home.
I'll be honest. I live in a house with no air conditioning. I probably would have gone to the theater for this and enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, I would have enjoyed it had I gone, or had I had the movie pass thing that led me to watch such gems as Uncle Drew a couple summers ago. This would have been right up my alley for that.
Also a fitting movie for a pandemic when you're sort of living the same day over and over, or we were a month or two ago, especially. So
can I ask, I'm just curious as to y'all's opinion about the last thing I saw. I have seen, Blaine, now I'm doing it. Kristen Milioti, what is her name? I've seen her in three things. I've seen her in How I Met Your Mother, which I can never watch again and will never watch again because of Game of Thrones itself. I've saw her in season two of Fargo, which is my favorite season of Fargo, one of my favorite shows ever. And I've seen her in this, and all three of those performances are very different performances.
She also had a very stellar episode of Modern Love. It's a Amazon anthology.
Okay.
It's just great anthology series, but that's what I remember her from the most.
What did we think about her performing here? Because my understanding is she hasn't done a ton. I mean, she's by no means a beginner, but I think her background is more, I think still she has more theater background. What did you think about her performance?
I thought she was good. I thought that, especially we've been kind of harping on Sandberg, and I wanted to make sure to note how much I enjoyed her in this role. She did a really good job with the, like, selling the depressed, dark, kind of angsty stuff at the beginning. And then when they had, you know, you have to have in these kind of movies that montage of like, they're just having fun together, like that kind of moment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she did such a good job seeming to like shed the skin of the life that she'd been living in those moments with him, that it was kind of like, it was surprising that, not surprising because it makes sense from the narrative, but that she was more hesitant about the relationship than he was. It seemed to be like a big liberation moment for her, but then she was also the one that had to reconsider and actually get him out of there. But I don't know. She did a good job kind of almost playing the straight man a few times, but also when she got out of that, being very impressive in that kind of crazier role too.
She's varied it up, I think, from time to time, and seeing her in this role is, I think she did a great job. That's how I'll phrase it.
And the most expressive eyes on screen.
She really does have like those big, big brown eyes.
Yeah.
She was in Fargo. She plays the wife of one of the main characters who's got cancer, right? And so she's probably going to die. And I think because season two takes place before season one does in time, I think we may even know that she dies. So all you have are those big eyes, like just like Bambi eyes the whole time. It's brutal.
Yeah. She's great.
All right. So, Palm Springs, good movie. If you haven't seen it already, we pretty much recommend it quite glowingly or close enough.
Yeah. I mean, if we were doing like Donovan said, he gave it 2.5 stars out of 4. I think for the genre, I'm going to give it a good 3 out of 4 stars. I'm in.
I think 3 out of 4 because I liked the snippet of sci-fi without bogging the movie down with sci-fi stuff. If that makes any sense.
Yeah,
I just like the little bit of a twist. And the headlines were right. It's not really a Groundhog Day kind of thing. Okay. We're going to go into a break on the back half. We're going to talk HBO's Perry Mason. All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening to Taking It Down. And before we talk about Perry Mason, we have a favor to ask, but it'll be quick and painless. Just share us online with your friends. Let them know we exist and rate us on your podcast app if you can. That, we found out that that was very helpful. In the meantime, you can always backtrack and listen to some of Taking It Down's old episodes on your podcast app or on our website, thealabamatake.com. Let's get into our discussion of Perry Mason. I'm going to revert to you guys once more for a little housekeeping because Last Chance U will premiere on Netflix. And Adam, this is because we've covered it on the show before. I'm going to ask, do we care as much about it this year?
So this will go about last year, right? This is the football team from last year, right? Because they're going to shift to basketball now, but we're getting one more football year. Am I right in this?
Well, I asked that for 3 reasons. So Number one, it's an absolutely new football team and coach. Okay. So we have to get used to a new coach personality and all these other personalities. Two, it's the last season with a focus on football, like you said. And Three, it usually readies me for the upcoming college season and NFL seasons, but I just don't know if those are going to happen or going to be so disjointed that it's going to be odd and maybe even not that entertaining. I don't know how that could be possible, but those are 3 reasons why I'm asking, do we care as much this year about Last Chance U?
I will definitely watch, but You know, it is one of there are a lot of great sports documentaries out there now that do this thing where they follow the team. If you love soccer, there's plenty of great ones. If you love the NFL, there's some great ones. And so this genre that it kind of helped invent, it's the most depressing out of all of those shows in a lot of ways. And I felt more willing to like be like, oh, this is just like human story. And like, I love those seasons and I'll probably watch again, but I'm with you in that it got me ready for football season. It definitely feels like August, September, October in the Deep South, though I know that they've been outside the Deep South lately. But, you know, with all of the good and the bad that entails, and I'm kind of with you that usually it's like we just missed SEC Media Days, right? That should have just happened.
Right.
And then this should be coming up soon, Last Chance U, and kind of getting us primed for football season and really the changing of seasons. Kind of we joked about how insufferably hot it is here today. Like, and that's kind of something to look forward to, that sweater weather looming, all those kind of things. But I don't know. This COVID has stripped us of all of that, and I would be in. I'm going to watch it, but that's a complicated answer to say. I'm going to watch it. I will watch the basketball version just because I feel like they have earned our trust at this point.
Right.
As storytellers. So yeah, I'll keep watching.
I'm with you. I'm definitely going to watch. We may even cover it here or talk about it some on the show. So, well, let's get into our second segment, which is HBO's Perry Mason. It's now on episode 5, or just wrapped episode 5. If you listen on Tuesday, that would be the most recent one. So what's this show doing for you? Donovan, let's start with you. What's this show doing for you?
You remember how I said I watched Persona, not Persona, Through a Glass Darkly right before Palm Springs? Well, yesterday I watched Vertigo right before I watched Perry Mason. So
okay.
I got to stop doing this, which didn't actually affect my enjoyment of the show. It's just, it's watching what Hitchcock does and this show is doing is probably, nobody looks good next to Hitchcock.
Huh.
I'm still enjoying it. I'm not looking for too much from it. It's summertime. I want something to kind of, I don't know, I want something to kind of relax into. They're doing some interesting things. It's well shot. It's well made. The acting is still consistently very good. If we're seeing the demise of Matthew Reese as the private, oh, two things. If we're seeing the demise of Matthew Reese as the private eye, I think I'll miss that a little bit if he's going to be more a lawyer. You kind of knew that he was probably going to end up doing that. But and the other thing was, I think it was, you noted something different in your show notes, but it, which I agree with you. But I think it was kind of last episode, really 3, 4, and 5. It's almost been more of an ensemble show. And I think it was, maybe it was last episode, or I really noticed it on the third episode. I felt like I was barely seeing Matthew Reese at all, which is kind of a shame because I really do like him. And I don't know. I almost wish we were spending a little bit more time with him. And I think they've got an hour. I think you, an hour and 8 or 10 episodes. I think you could do it. That being said, I'm not furious or pitching a fit because I think everybody else in the cast is doing a great job. R.I.P. E.B.
It's, you talk about a summertime viewing and wanting to just get lost in something and relax and be calmly shifted into another place. Period pieces, if they're done as well as this one, and I'm talking about the set design, the clothing, the acting, the lighting, I mean everything. If it's done as well as this version of Perry Mason is, it's easy to just forget where you are for 55 minutes. Adam, what about you? What's this show doing for you?
I think a similar thing, talking about kind of the period drama, the California in that age. It's all so well done. Even I marvel every time there's like a shot of a busy street. I don't know how much is CGI and how much is them just like finding 50 old cars like that to get zipping by. I love all that stuff. Attention to detail. I'm with you, Donovan, that this seemed to be the Batman gets his first uniform kind of
yes.
episode when he discovers and quickly becomes a lawyer.
Quickly becomes a lawyer.
Turns out it's not
Jesus
hard.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, which we can talk about later. But if that ends his kind of, you know, there's the foreshadowing when he goes to see his ex and she says, you're still like going through people's stuff as this PI. I was like, yeah, and he's awesome at it. It rules. This kind of like grimy underworld thing. I actually have the, maybe not the opposite reaction, but as things have pulled back from just him to more of an ensemble piece, I've enjoyed it more because I think everybody's so strong in their role. Like, I think that Tatiana Maslany is incredible in what she's doing. I don't know. I think it's all great. I think all of the, I'm starting to finally, you know, we joked about this is a lot of white dudes in hats to keep track of. They're all starting to distinguish themselves. The world gets a little bit bigger. Yeah, no, it's one of those where at this point in the story, it's been a little while since we've just been confronted with details about the case. And so every time they go back to that, I have to reorient a bit. And I feel like it's coming where they're really going to lay it out on the table. So that was fun early on, and now that it's shifted to this bigger thing, I get what you're saying. But yeah, it's almost easier for me to enjoy without worrying about all those details, which can kind of bog me down at times.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with you. Kind of where it's like, I think what ultimately keep, you know, if you've ever read like a collection of like locked room mysteries, they're mystery stories, and they're often technically proficient, but about halfway through the book, you're like, who cares?
Yeah.
This is not something that ever happened to real people. And I mean, this isn't exactly, I mean, no work of fiction is, but I feel like the characters are, I'm enjoying spending time with them. The only thing, especially the past couple episodes, is the, I feel like they kind of sidelined the black police officer. He's had stuff to do, and they're kind of, you know, they're showing the racism of the era, and you know, they've been, you know, they had that, I can't, last episode that presumably we didn't see the debater, but it was whoever was debating against more of a Booker T. Washington style progress. But they kind of, you know, he had kind of stuff to do where he was interacting, and you can kind of guess that there's at what they might be setting him up for, but he really, you know, it's a shame because he, the first couple, you know, when he was like discovering the extra evidence and Perry was trying to get to him and he, you know, he slugs Perry and all,
that was a great scene.
Yeah. And that was, and it was interesting and he feels a little bit more on the periphery. Right.
Yeah,
now.
And it, they also are,
they'll hook him in more, but
they're also kind of going a little bit more on the nose with, you know, I mean, there was a literal debate about
yes
how progress should be made, and that felt a little heavy-handed. I mean, not that it wasn't, it's disingenuous to its time, but like as viewers, we kind of understand these things. And now that he's maybe trying to put his work life and the racism there to one side and then say this is family life, like everything's fine. And then they get pushed off the beach and now he's going to have this awakening moment. It's kind of like this show has done other things in more interesting ways. It probably could have done that in a slightly more interesting way. I mean, what that exchange with Perry was so good and so jarring. And like, you know, they used language that got your attention. And I don't know, it'll be, I'm with you that he has an interesting story. It'll be, I hope that it turns compelling again, instead of being kind of like the side thing.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of a good way to say this. And I think that, because I don't want to criticize, I think it's cool that they're ground, you know, something that, you know, if you watch old noirs, if you ever see a black character, it's like, you know, or even it's not a noir, but like in Nick and Nora's, sorry, not Nick and Nora's, in The Thin Man, there's no black character until right at the end, there's a train porter. You know, they're subservient role. They're not really characters. They're more like, you know, they're only there to be kind of like background extras. And so I think it's cool that they're trying to foreground him and his struggle, you know, because it's like that kind of, it's so wild. I'm presuming all this stuff was written before we were talking about this again, but right, that kind of like slow incremental progress versus do we have to fight and take what's ours? The shame is that they seem to have kind of like what Adam said, seemed to not be able to figure out how to do that except by kind of having him have these experiences that don't really drive, you know, he's out on the side of the story. And I'm afraid that by trying to do something, you know, good and by trying to give him the screen time and all that, kind of, they're going to end up doing the actor and the character a disservice because he's very good.
Yeah, he is. He had the well-acted scene with his wife in the bed.
Very good. She's good too.
Yeah, she is. And it's reminiscent to me of Boardwalk Empire. And I can see them doing a second season course correction with this show as well. Boardwalk Empire had Michael K. Williams, who's gone on to do a lot more. He had done The Wire at that point, of course. But with Boardwalk Empire, he was used a little here and there in the first season and the second through. Well, to the end, he was a major player and even had some of his own kind of episodes, so to speak. I can definitely see them doing that with this police officer, assuming he lives until the end.
Mm-hmm.
So, Donovan, I know you're a big fan of the actress Tatiana Maslany, but what do you think about the character of Sister Alice and the notion that she's hearing from God to resurrect this dead baby who propelled the narrative?
I was actually thinking, because we were going to be talking about this today. And I was watching last night's episode and thinking about Tatiana Maslany's acting, and it's very different than what I've seen before. Whereas Orphan Black, it wasn't necessarily scenery chewing, although she did get to do a lot of that. But it was a very different kind of acting because she was supposed to be playing different characters, different people, right? They're all her, but she's playing them. And this one, her acting here is maybe going to make everyone laugh, and I might just be an idiot, but almost more subtle. In the sense that, like, she is, radio evangelist character, right? Like, we kind of know this character, but she's playing her not as a grifter. She's playing her, you know, sometimes she turns on, like, kind of this warmth and charm, but also she's always playing for cameras, too, at the same time. It seems like she has to do a lot. You know, she kind of has to keep this same pleasant face on all the time. So there's a lot with eyes and down glances. And I think she's doing a good job. I think we kind of want to be in her corner, right? Because She's fighting for Alice, this poor woman who's clearly being railroaded, right? She has a lot of sympathy for Alice. But at the same time, we know that she's absolutely nuts, right? She's not going to resurrect this baby. Now, what the show's going to do with that, I have no idea. I think that there was real-life stuff, too. I think there may be the... Because it's supposed to be sort of a... If you'll note from their flags and whatever, it's an Assemblies of God-type church. And I think there was... I don't know. I feel like there was something out in California that was had similar real-life things. So, yeah, I think she's doing a good job.
You made me laugh a bit when you said subtle. You put the disclaimer on it, but I totally get what you're saying, because while she does have these scenes where she's very flamboyant in the middle of a crowd, you know, like say early on, her interaction with Mason is very subtle. Like the way that she treats him in that boardroom kind of esque meeting versus the way everybody else treats him is so different, and it's done in such a small way. And she does things like down glances, or like I've noticed that she stares into people's eyes much longer than any other character.
Yeah.
Like she's unafraid to stare at him, to laugh at his coarse joke, to do whatever. And you just kind of see that her and her mother both talk as if they're at the center of the storm and not observing it in the same way. It's not really religion to them. Like it's like this thing that they're actually believing in, which I know is like a religious concept, but it's just like it is life to them versus like a construct that everybody else has bought into.
Yep.
So they're not as committed to the rules, I guess, or the expectations of the people around them, especially the people around them who are, you know, pouring money onto a table to count it out. Talking about heavy-handed.
The coming clash between Mason and Sister Alice, it's the likely coming, you know, ostensibly that could be what happened. What are your thoughts about the character of Della Street?
Played I think by she's her? Great.
She's yeah. fun. She's a lot of fun. The woman playing her is doing a good job.
Yeah, Juliet Rylance, I think her name is.
You know, even just kind of, again, last episode, right? It was almost a Della episode.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of felt like Della was driving the action. She's certainly dragging Perry along. And we kind of got to see her from finding EB to, you know, to coming up with her list of lawyers and making all the calls. You know, there's a lot of, she got a lot to do. And I don't think that she's had, I don't think she's had trouble with any of it.
And she's been in the background.
She's been a lot of fun.
She's been in the background quite a bit. Not literally, but in terms of progressing the story and legal terms, preparing briefs, all these kind of law, they're actually submitting whatever they have to submit on the, you know, she's doing the legwork, and she's not just like the clerk. She's actually doing a lot of the investigating and a lot of the putting pieces together. And she, you know, she gets furious at EB one time and says, when I say and associates, that's me.
Yeah.
There is nobody else. And there's the exploration of sexism here is maybe a little bit more handled a little bit better than maybe the racism in terms of its integration into the story, because, you know, she is kind of puppeteering a lot of different stuff and using, like, playing her role to the best of her ability when she knows that she can't just take the case at this point in time. Like she obviously is more than capable of it, but she's been guiding it so far. And she, even when she makes the list, she's trying to hand it off to the right person. I mean, she hides evidence, all this stuff. She's much more than just like an assistant to the story, both in terms of like in that office and to the story. She's not just an assistant to the narrative.
Yeah, they made it very clear that, I mean, the show has made it very clear that, like, if she hadn't been doing what she, you know, because the EB's fallen apart, basically, nothing would have happened without her. And even she's firmer and stronger than EB, right? Like, she's able to kind of strong arm her way into the back and save Alice from the interrogation. Also, can I mention too, and I'm going to forget his name, great character actor. He's the guy playing the DA, and I, because I wanted to bring him up, I've now
Stephen
completely
Root.
Forgot his name. Thank you. How great is Stephen Root?
He just seems
slimy. And he talks like this.
Mm-hmm. He's so great in Barry too.
He's so good in Barry. Every And that's been the last thing I saw him in was Barry. Yeah. So seeing him like just as slimy, but like he's kind of grosser in Barry, if that makes sense. And this way, he's the slick guy in the suit with the little oily mustache. Every time he's on camera, I'm just grinning because he's just evil.
Him addressing the press is some of the funniest scenes.
Oh man, yeah. Or when he kicked everyone out of the bathroom.
Yes.
Oh, that was
a great
scene. You
can't look away when he's on screen.
Wash your hands.
Back to Matthew Rhys. I think that he is at his best when he's allowed to go from melancholic to threatening. Like he did that a lot in The Americans.
Yeah, he did.
And we get the dangerous side of Perry Mason when he attacks this new lawyer in episode 5, Dylan, I think is his name or his last name, who's been assigned the case. And he's been assigned it by the Stephen Root DA character just to fail. And seeing Perry Mason in that dangerous mode, I think could really make this show explode, despite us as viewers already having tons of anti-hero shows prior to this one. Because of Matthew Rhys, you know.
Well, and it's, you know, when he exploded today, right? Like, he's not really the anti-hero. Like, maybe you probably shouldn't, like, beat folks up, right? But at the same time, he's trying to get an innocent woman off. And she's been, you know, she's being railroaded.
Yeah, he's fighting corruption when he holds the guy up against the wall with the book. And it's very violent and sudden and... that scene really worked because he hasn't been that guy so far. He's only kind of like apathetically suffered through physical punishment from others. So like to see him dish it out was to see what finally pushed him to the point of dishing it out was a good character development moment.
Anti-hero in the sense, I guess, of his backstory because of the World War I stuff he had to do.
Sure. Well, but they even kind of paint that as like.
Mercy.
Yeah, you know, where it's like, I mean, I'm pretty sure that's technically what he did was technically a war crime, but and he did get court-martialed for it, but at the same time, right, it's almost I feel like I'm gonna get canceled for saying this, but in a sense it's a selfless act, right? He's not thinking of his career, he's not thinking of himself, he's thinking of this soldier who's choking from a chlorine gas attack. Right. Whereas, like, I think of like, where does Walter White's arc end up? Right. It ends up with him admitting, I did it for me. I did it because it felt good. And I mean, isn't that, you know, if we're going to connect it with kind of the TV lawyer, right? Like, he takes risks. Perry Mason, the TV lawyer, right? Like, he takes risks. He fights for the defenseless, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I do think that there's like, and maybe that's even more dangerous, right? Like if we're thinking about quote unquote, like morals or messages, right? Like maybe that's even more dangerous because maybe it just perpetuates the idea that we can cut corners as long as that, you know, that doing things the right way doesn't matter. I would also argue that in the context of I think that a noir does this in a different way than a cop show does this, because in a noir, the power, you know, like when say on Law and Order or whatever, they cut corners to get the bad guy. I think that does one message. I think in noir, it's kind of understood that the system is already corrupt and rigged against you. So it's the understanding is kind of like you can't do things the right way because the law isn't set up, you know, like, yeah, I'm breaking the law, right? But I'm breaking the law because the law isn't set up to protect the powerless. So if I want to protect the powerless, I have to do something else. So possibly the difference is overly subtle. But I do think that the noir does help us to think about, you know, there's the law and there's what's right.
They've made points already about, you know, you talk to the Los Angeles Police Department about that, like, you know, that you can't trust. They even talked about the corruption. We saw corruption at two levels inside the, once inside the DA's office and then once in the investigator's office where the guy who was up for the case, we meet him and he got jumped because someone bought the case, basically. So they wanted, the DA wanted a certain person to get it. And then we have the guy who tells Perry how to memorize the bar exam, which I was thinking, who is this guy? And I realized the actor very quickly. It is the brother-in-law from Weeds, right? Came along to teach Perry the bar exam. But it's pointed out that, you know, he's telling him this so that the head DA can lose this case and he can slip right into that job. Like it's all corrupt. Like you said, like there's no finding the good guy is almost impossible.
And how do we feel about the yada yada-ing of him becoming a lawyer? Do we appreciate the fact that they didn't bog the story down with that? Or did we find it ridiculous that, hey, in 2 weeks you can be a lawyer?
It was a little ridiculous. I was like, he must have a really good memory. But at the same time, I'm a little glad I didn't have a whole episode of him studying for the bar.
We didn't.
You know?
Did we not need a montage of him boxing against
shadow boxing a law book?
Yeah,
that would have been great. But it also, you know, Della tells him, you probably know more about this than you think you do. So maybe it's also like a credit to his character that he could absorb that. He didn't have that much to learn. You know, maybe that's like the point they're trying to make.
I think we were supposed to guess that when, you know, he kind of blows up, right? And she gets the idea and he's like, there's no physical evidence. You know, he's making these connections. I think we're supposed to suspect that he actually understands how this works.
And it does set him up for these future seasons that, you know, are coming, for him to have to defend that he's got a law degree or how he got it or whatever.
Yeah, I hope they don't send him back to community college.
With Pierce and
it's all a long con about the community.
But you're talking about the guy who comes in to kind of coach him through the mm-hmm. passing the bar. The character's name is Hamilton Berger, who apparently is a character from the other iterations of the show, the previous ones from the 50s and 60s that aired with Raymond Burr as Perry Mason. So there's
somewhere
like,
I try to think about who in the crowd for this show in 2020, like who is old enough but also like still down with this gritty a show, and they're just like psyched at all these reveals. You know what I mean? Like I don't know all of it. It's like
the Perry Mason verse, you know, like.
But you got to think that the people who love that show, A, that are still alive, and B, want to watch an HBO style. You know, not that it's like the most raw show on HBO, but it's got its gritty moments.
Definitely.
Like there can't be that much. I mean, we're talking like a there are dozens of us kind of situation, right? There cannot be that many.
Absolutely.
It's us three and maybe another guy or girl.
Yeah.
It's us three and clearly Robert Downey Jr.
Robert Downey Jr. could be another one of the people.
Well, he's kicking money in, so.
Oh, for sure. This show's getting some middling, I'll call it, not negative, middling reviews. It's been called bland. I've seen it called bland, and I've seen it kind of what you guys were talking about, just a CBS show, but grittier. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with that. I think it's better than that, and it's got my attention, and it's entertained me much more than any of those reviews would let on.
Yeah, I think it's probably the strength of the acting, and, you know, good production and set design goes a heck of a long way. Just having it not, you know how, like, those CBS shows where they're producing 26 episodes a season, right? So it's like you've got to figure out something to do week from week. You know, there's only so much money. You know, not that they can't be great, but it can help when you don't have some of those headwinds against you.
I will say, I don't think that this show has quite achieved liftoff for me yet. I'm not discounting its ability to do it down the road, but I can kind of understand, based on the cast and the budget and all of these things, why somebody might say it's punching a little bit below its weight.
Yeah.
Like, I'm tuning in every Sunday night, but I could understand why a reviewer might feel that way.
Yeah, I suppose so. And if nothing else, and we've said it 1,000 times on this show, but if nothing else, I'm going to tune in to see what Matthew Reese does.
Yep.
And seeing him pin the guy against the wall and make that threatening gesture last night's episode, episode 5 of last night, whatever. You guys know we record on Monday, but yep.
Absolutely. Yeah, so kind of going up what Adam said, I'm more that I'm expecting this show to not if I'm expecting this show to not stick the landing necessarily. That's where I think it's more going to fall apart, if I had to guess.
This is also one of those shows, I alluded to this briefly, this is also one of those shows that could very well age excellently. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Season four and five could be like...
could go either way.
Yeah, it could be like the most amazing thing you've seen.
Absolutely. Yeah, I hope so.
Which is kind of the opposite of like a lot of... there's so much miniseries stuff today, or anthologized kind of stuff, that like thinking of something being produced at this level, setting up future seasons is kind of a shift, like a mindset shift for me. Because so much is kind of just like 8 and out or 10 and out or whatever it is. And even though the arc of this case seems like it's going to wrap up this season, seeing every brick be put into place for like a longer running show, I can see how that platform is being built for sure. I will say, if that's true, I'm going to be bummed that EB and the most distracting mustache of all time had to get out of the way early on. Can I ask you guys about that? That mustache. Are you not just like staring at it every time he was on screen?
You know what annoyed me more? That CGI hummingbird that was some sort of metaphor. It's like, here's EB. Guess we're going to have to deal with that fucking hummingbird soon.
The mustache didn't distract me as much as Steven Root's mustache does.
Oh, I love Steven Root's mustache.
It looks like
a grease pencil.
It's such a excellent mustache.
It's so gross. I love it.
Bill Dotrieve, gone to the big city.
Absolutely.
But yeah, this one is, you can see how it's going to build upon season after season, or perhaps you can see that it's going to get a second season. I had one of HBO's, the debut of the first episode, or what that is, the debut, had some high ratings for HBO. They released that, which they don't normally talk about a ton. That is promising for more episodes. Unlike, let's say, a Normal People season two, normaler people, you know? I mean, what are you going to do there, yeah, right? But this one, you can see what they could do.
I would be excited to see how, if they did do, like, okay, Perry's the lawyer now, if they were still kind of able to ground it in that sort of, in the noir.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that would actually be kind of cool.
I think what you'd have to do is have him do a lot of his investigative work as well as lawyer work. And you see him recruiting Shea Whigham's character when he becomes the law. You know, that's still going to be a bond. I'm pumped to watch this show week to week. I really am. I don't think it works as a binge. It's a week to week show and it's doing amazing.
Absolutely.
Stuff.
Yeah, it's fun. I'm enjoying it.
I say it's doing amazing stuff. It's doing really good stuff. That's the way I should phrase that. Well, folks, that's the end of our episode. What we'll do is we'll come back at you next Tuesday. Subscribe to us so that you don't miss an episode. Check with us on social media, especially Twitter, where we announce what we're going to be covering a day or two before the podcast release, so you can kind of keep up to date on that. Leave us a review online, and we'll talk to you all later.